The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Israel continues to defend itself.
It started because Hamas started firing hundreds of rocket missiles into heavily populated cities in Israel. It's pretty simple. And it will end when Hamas's war machine is defeated.
There's a troubling amount of anti-Semitism out there.
If you are pro-Israel, you are really a racist.
We'll take a look at the dangerous traits of the Palestinian leadership.
For them reeling, for them suffering loss to a very large extent is a good thing. Okay? It makes them look like heroes. It makes them look like they are suffering for the Palestinian cause.
And later, an abortion bill heads to the Supreme Court.
We're very hopeful that we're going to see some changes in abortion jurisprudence in this country.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Please follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. It is hard to imagine that there are still people who argue that Israel has no right to defend itself from an attacking enemy. Some who even argue it has no right to exist. It's been said many times, but I'll repeat it here. If a nearby country, say Cuba, started launching missiles into the United States, the response from the United States military would be swift and brutal. The intent wouldn't be to reduce the number of missiles being fired, but to stop them forever. And nobody would argue against it. Israelis live in a world Americans simply cannot imagine. Underground bunkers, sirens. They are surrounded by enemies, many of whom would annihilate them if given a chance. I spoke this week with Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton, a combat veteran, member of the Armed Services Committee in the Senate. Earlier today, I played your remarks on the floor of the Senate about Israel and the AP. I don't imagine the media much like that, but I compliment you on calling these issues out.
The AP has some uncomfortable questions they need to answer. Everyone probably knows by now that Israel struck a building in Gaza that Hamas intelligence was using to target Israeli citizens. That building also happened to house the AP and other news media. Israel, as is its practice, gave the innocent civilians in the building advance warning so they could evacuate, which of course means that Hamas gets advance warning and terrorists regrettably get away. But that's because Israel respects human life, unlike Hamas. The AP and other reporters got up in high moral dudgeon about this fact. But one has to ask, did the AP not know who their neighbors were? I mean, there's evidence out there, Hugh, from videos to former AP reporters saying that they've known for years they were sharing office building with Hamas, basically allowing themselves to be used as human shields, all the while suppressing what Hamas was doing in that building, firing rockets away or trying to terrorize reporters. So I think it's incumbent upon AP leadership to explain exactly how long they have known that they were sharing an office with a U.S. designated terrorist organization.
Now, you also posed on Twitter a very penetrating question. Would AP share a building with Al-Qaeda? And I'd like you to make the point. Al-Qaeda and Hamas are, in the eyes of the United States government, the same thing, designated terrorist organizations.
Yeah, there is no difference between Al-Qaeda and Hamas to radical Sunni Islamic terrorist organizations. They are both designated by the United States as terrorist organizations. Would the AP or would any of their defenders in this controversy be willing to share office space with Al-Qaeda? If they learned that Al-Qaeda was upstairs or down the hall, would they stay in that office space? Would they go to the authorities and report on what they had discovered? I think these are some of the uncomfortable questions that the AP leadership needs to answer, Hugh.
Now, I also talked with Matt Continetti of AEI and Fred Barnes of the Washington Examiner this morning. about the media's coverage of the Israeli self-defense, but it does seem to me that the American media has gone significantly anti-Israel, far more than it's ever been before. Do you see that, Senator Cotton?
Unfortunately, Hugh, the American media, of course, usually reflects the opinion of the elite left in this country, and the left in this country has become increasingly anti-Israel in recent years. You see that from elected Democrats who are calling Israel an apartheid state and demanding that we cut off our support to Israel, or that Israel's leaders be charged for war crimes. Those opinions marinated in campus seminar rooms and marches out in our streets are reflected by their peers and former classmates and their friends in the American media. And that's why you get news media asking, how could this happen? Why did this war start now? Well, it started because Hamas started firing hundreds of rocket missiles into heavily populated cities in Israel. It's pretty simple. And it will end when Hamas's war machine is defeated.
Some on the left have disparaged Israel as they defend themselves. They've even compared the situation of Palestinians to the worst sort of discrimination against black Americans. Salem host Larry Elder examines that comparison.
A lot of these Democrats are hostile to Israel. I mean, really hostile. Rashida Tlaib refers to Israel as an apartheid state.
I mean, this is an apartheid system. I mean, Israel's own prominent human rights organization, B'Tselem, has declared it. Human Rights Watch has declared it. And Palestinians on the ground have been telling us for decades that they've been, their homes have been demolished, that they've been targeted, that they, that violence has been met by Israeli-led forces.
And what they've done is to tie the, quote, plight, close quote, of black Americans to the plight of the Palestinians.
Under Netanyahu's racist policies. What we're really telling Palestinians fighting apartheid is the same thing being told to my fellow black Americans across our country here.
Here we go.
And that are
what they're doing to the Palestinians is the same thing as what the white man is doing to black people in America.
Fighting against police brutality. There is no form of acceptable resistance to state violence, except the denial of, except for the denial of, you know, people's human dignity. And we need to stop. We need to stop and look at the fact that our own country is enabling it with billions of dollars every year being issued to Israel, even though they are promoting racism and dehumanization.
She doesn't mention the aid given to the Palestinians. On a per capita basis, they receive more money per person than did Europe regarding the Marshall Plan after the Second World War. Again, tying it to black people in America.
Our freedom is interconnected with black, brown, indigenous.
Interconnected.
It is connected.
Interconnected.
What they are doing to the Palestinian people.
So if you are pro-Israel, you are really a racist.
It's what they continue to do to our black brothers and sisters here, to the immigrant community here.
What they're doing to our black brothers and sisters is the same thing that they're doing to the Palestinians in Israel. Really?
So I want you to know this. If you are marching for freedom of thought.
Okay. Ayanna Pressley, same thing.
Last summer, when Black Lives Matter protesters took to the streets to demand justice, they were met with force. They faced tear gas, rubber bullets, and a militarized police, just as our Palestinian brothers and sisters are facing in Jerusalem today.
Same thing, you see. You know that Hamas, they put things in civilian areas so that they get these casualties, so they get these visions, and then people like that stand up and talk about how inhumane Israel is. It's ridiculous. Here's what Bibi Netanyahu said about that.
But here's what happens. When the international community attacks Israel, they're actually encouraging Hamas to continue these attacks because Hamas says, it's great. We're both killing Israeli civilians and unfortunately some of our, and they're happy with their own civilian casualties because it gets that, the international community to focus their attacks on Israel instead of Hamas. That's wrong.
Sure.
It's both wrong and unproductive because actually what it does is prolong the conflict and escalate and increase the number of casualties that that happen as a result of the continuation of the conflict.
He was asked by CBS's John Dickerson, given how powerful Israel is, don't you have a moral obligation, a responsibility to restrain yourself when you're defending yourself?
Tony Blinken said that Israel has an extra burden, that Israel, because of its strength and power and dominance, has an extra burden on these question of casualties. The question is whether Israel is meeting its extra burden in responding to these rocket attacks from Hamas.
You certainly are. And I can tell you that there have been many studies by serious military analysts who have compared Israel's actions with that of other Western armies in similar situations fighting radical Islamists, whether it's in Iraq or in Afghanistan or elsewhere. And you know how prolonged those conflicts are, how many casualties are caused. So I think there is a there has to be a measure of fairness. There has to be a measure of reasonableness in projecting this kind of criticism against the Israeli army that is second to none in seeking to minimize civilian casualties while protecting our own civilians. If Hamas would simply move these rockets out of the civilian areas, if they move their command posts out of these homes and offices, then there wouldn't be any problem.
Let me ask you, Mr. Prime Minister.
But the fact is, they're sending thousands of rockets on our cities with the specific purpose of murdering our civilians from these places.
Let me ask you,
what would you do?
Let me ask
if it happened to Washington or to New York, you know damn well what you do.
Let me ask you,
you do at the very least what we're doing.
And can I remind you that the State Department has determined for decades that Hamas is a terror organization?
Salem Media just launched a podcast called Meeting of the Minds, hosted by my friend Jerry Boyer of Town Hall Finance. Jerry will be having deep and substantive conversations about things that matter, things that will outlast the current news cycle. In his first episode, Boyer spoke with PayPal founder Peter Thiel. One might assume they spoke business. Not at all. The two of them covered victimhood as it related to New Testament times.
In essence, the Gospels are, they're not just turning the pagan myths upside down. They're turning Platonism, Aristotelianism, the whole project upside down.
Yes, Girard would always stress more the discontinuity between mythology and Christianity. And you have certainly a lot of, you know, the great medieval theologians like Aquinas who tried to synthesize the two. And Girard would say that we should also perhaps stress some of the differences and some of the ways in which Christianity was radically different. And then, of course, on a cultural level, you know, maybe there were a few idiosyncratic people who could sort of figure some stuff out and they were too scared to tell anybody about it and sort of say, what did that really matter? But when the idea of a victim, the idea that victims exist, it comes from Judeo-Christianity and nowhere else. You know, if you sort of imagine Christ in the time of Pontius Pilate, if he had told Pilate, you know, I am a victim, this would have made no sense whatsoever. You know, Pilate would have said, no, are you a Roman citizen or not? And the idea that you were a victim made no sense at all. And Girard would claim that this was, you know, gradually as the Christian story became internalized, as it became the basis for a Christian culture in the Middle Ages, it was partially Christian, partially not, but you gradually got the society, and then, you know, you get to all sorts of ways where, you know, it's maybe deformed, maybe gone crazy in modernity, where, you know, we talk about victims and nothing else.
To listen to the first Meeting of the Minds, go to meetingofthemindspodcast.com. That's meetingofthemindspodcast.com. Coming up, abortion is back before the Supreme Court.
We're very hopeful that we're going to see some changes in abortion jurisprudence in this country.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. To understand what Israel is going through, one must understand the enemy they face in this current battle, Hamas, a designated terror group that now has money and a home from which to attack the very people they seek to wipe off the face of the earth, Israeli. I spoke this week with former Israeli ambassador to the United States, Dr. Michael Oren, who is in Israel now. I wanted to ask you about two things, the ceasefire and the political situation in Israel. First, the ceasefire. President Biden, I went back and compared with President Obama, has followed exactly the construction that President Obama used in the last Gaza war of 2014. But in 10 days, President Obama went from Israel has a right to defend itself to demanding a unilateral ceasefire. Do you expect the same thing from Team Biden?
Not demanding. And I'll tell you why, two reasons. First of all, that with context, when Obama made that demand, Israel was operating on the ground. And I don't see any large-scale ground operation in the works right now. We haven't called up the requisite number of reservists. There hasn't been that type of buildup along the border that you need of strategically 15,000, 70,000 soldiers. I don't see that right now. So that's one. what can I say? President Biden is not President Obama. America was in a different position globally back then to make that type of demands. America has withdrawn a lot from the Middle East, and that has it impacted its leverage. And so the means through which this administration can pressure Israel are not what they were 10 years ago.
I am also impressed by what I understand to be and appears to be an evolution in weaponry so that Israel, with using precision munitions that can go deep, is systematically destroying the so-called metro. Am I right about that?
Yes, you're right about that. And that has relieved some of the pressure on us to go in on the ground, because now you can do it from the air, which what soldiers had to do on the ground before, actually going, you know, ferreting into these holes and blowing them up, which was tremendously dangerous for a soldier. We lost a number of soldiers doing that. That's a big improvement. I think that behind all this, and we can't lose sight of the big strategic picture view, and that is who is behind this? Behind this is the major backer of Hamas, the exclusive owner and operator of Islamic Jihad, which is Iran. And that's the same Iran with which this administration is engaged in negotiations to renew the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. And I think that, you know, while credit has to be given to this administration for standing by Israel and upholding our right to defend ourselves, I also question, you know, at the end of this, when we go back into that negotiation with the Iranians about the JCPOA, will the administration say, well, listen, Israel, we stood by you in your hour of need in Gaza. Now, why don't you stand down a little bit while we renew this nuclear deal?
So, Dr. Oren, you're a very sober judge of these things. So I just ask you, is Hamas reeling? That's an American term that I think applies to lots of wars. Is the enemy reeling?
Okay. Everything you know about war, everything you know about conflict, when it comes to Hamas, throw it out. Okay, that for them reeling, for them suffering loss to a very large extent is a good thing. Okay, it makes them look like heroes. It makes them look like they are suffering for the Palestinian cause. If Israel inflicts damage on civilians in Gaza inadvertently, it's good for Hamas. I've spoken before on this program how Iron Dome is a double-edged sword, yet it creates disproportionality. It enables Hamas to say, look at all how we're suffering while the Israelis aren't suffering hardly at all. So they get credit for firing rockets at us, but they also get credit when we shoot back at them. Everything you understand. It was very difficult for a year and a half. I was in charge of Gaza for the Israeli government, and it took me a long time to wrap my head around the fact that Hamas actually likes humanitarian disaster in Gaza. It likes keeping the Palestinian people with nothing to lose, keeping them dependent on Hamas. They're immensely cruel. They use hundreds of kids to dig these tunnels, and hundreds of kids are killed every year digging this tunnel. They don't care. All right? The international community doesn't care, but the Hamas doesn't care. Everything you know about pretty much about human beings you can throw out the window when you talk about Hamas.
The United States Supreme Court agreed to take up a Mississippi abortion case because that state has banned abortions after 15 weeks. The now conservative court has the opportunity to directly address abortion and the legal rationale of Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. That has the left worried and the right cautiously optimistic. Kevin McCullough spoke with Gene Mancini, president of March for Life, on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
Give us, from your perspective, what you think this case represents and what it could possibly determine the outcome of.
Got it. Okay. This is extraordinarily significant for a lot of reasons. With the newest makeup of the Supreme Court, we have not seen them take up an abortion bill, a pro-life bill, in some time. And so it's very exciting, A, that is happening. But B, Kevin, as you were articulating there really well, this will ask some very basic questions that is very much to the essence of what Roe and Doe back in 1973 decided. So One of the single most important points that it's taking up, the critical question, has to do with viability, which simply means when the baby can live on its own outside of the womb. And the bottom line is that Roe and Doe basically made constitutional that abortion could be limited, pro-life laws could be enacted after viability. What this lawsuit will do is question if pro-life laws can be enacted prior to viability. It really, it's even like bigger and broader than that. Is there any possibility of any pro-life law being enacted prior to viability is essentially what this is asking. And I think that the answer has to be yes. And so for those reasons, we're very hopeful that we're going to see some changes in abortion jurisprudence in this country.
So from the standpoint of the level of burden that has to be proven here, it would be easy to say that science has developed a great deal about what we know inside the womb since Roe was decided, because it was the oldest, but also with Doe and Casey versus Planned Parenthood and all the rest. I mean, these are cases that all kind of are dependent upon this theory that that's not a human being, that there's no actual human involved here, that this is just a, you know, lifeless cluster of cells that don't mean anything. The science now shows otherwise, from everything from the beautiful 3D ultrasounds to what we know about how the nervous system develops and everything else. So how open do you think the court's makeup right now is towards receiving that new information and hearing these arguments?
Kevin, these are great questions.
Thank you. Thank you.
By way of clarification, the Attorney General in Mississippi posed in this case to the Supreme Court three questions. The first is the question that is going to be taken up by the court, which is it possible to have pro-life laws prior to viability? The second is, what is viability? Should we revisit viability, which is exactly what you were just asking, Kevin? And then the third is, do abortion clinics have what's called third party standing? They've got a conflict of interest, a financial conflict of interest. Should they really, you know, be able to be a third party in the quote unquote third party in these abortion cases? The Supremes will not take up the second or the third question. They are very, very laser focused on the first question about can laws be passed prior to viability, but will they actually discuss what viability is? No, they will not answer number two.
Coming up, the bewildering complaint about Israel's Iron Dome.
And Gaza terrorists don't have anything equivalent to the Iron Dome. So it gives Israel an unfair advantage.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Hi, everyone. Hugh Hewitt for Bambi. That's right, Bambi. Have you heard of it before? B-A-M-B-E-E. It was created specifically for small businesses because we know that small businesses can often get sunk by HR problems. HR issues can kill your business. Well, Bambi is here to save you that problem. It is specifically designed for small business. You get a dedicated HR manager, craft your HR policy, and maintain your compliance all for just $99 a month. Now, I've run a couple of law firms, I run a foundation, and I run a business. And I know that HR is a headache. It doesn't have to be. Bambi can change it from a headache to a profit center overnight. From onboarding to termination, Bambi will customize your policies to fit your business. Go to Bambi.com/townhall right now to schedule your free HR audit. That's Bambi.com/townhall. Bambee.com/townhall. Bambee.com/townhall. You'll be glad you did. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the school at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. By now, most of you have seen the pictures of Israel's Iron Dome in action. On the right, straight lines from missiles fired from the Gaza towards Israel. On the left, a cluster of squiggly lines, the Iron Dome in action as it knocks out those missiles midair. Without the Iron Dome, hundreds, indeed thousands of missiles fired from the terrorist group Hamas would have devastated Israel and its people. Remarkably, some have suggested the Iron Dome is actually prolonging the war. Here's Mike Gallagher.
As terrorists lobbed rockets into Israel, there was a Washington Post editorial that essentially criticized the Iron Dome because it's not, because the Palestinian And Gaza terrorists don't have anything equivalent to the Iron Dome. So it gives Israel an unfair advantage. You know, they'd be able to wipe Israeli children and men and women out if they didn't have the Iron Dome. And this is prolonging the conflict a little more. Listen to this analysis by somebody named Yagil Levy. Washington Post. This is not some fringe, lunatic, far-left, you know, website somewhere. This is the Washington Post. Headline, Israel's Iron Dome defense system protects Israeli lives. It also perpetuates the Israel-Gaza conflict. I'm kidding you not. This person is arguing that the Iron Dome allows the conflict to continue because the tactics, the Iron Dome, perpetuates the conflict. Here's the ironic outcome, the editorial says. Even as Iron Dome enables devastating Israeli bombardments from the air, it protects Gazan civilians from potentially devastating outcomes of an Israeli ground offensive, which would be the likely alternative. The increasing legal scrutiny of Israel's wars gives Israel an interest in diminishing global pressure for military restraint and a political solution. The Iron Dome has saved Israeli lives from Gaza rocket attacks. But the reduced pressure to resolve the conflict with Gaza also means Iron Dome gives Israelis a false sense of security based on technological success, which isn't guaranteed forever, rather than political solutions. There's actually a Washington Post editorial opining that since Israel has state-of-the-art, extraordinary missile defense system, it's continuing the conflict since the Hamas terrorists don't have a similar protection against Israeli attacks. Hamas, they say, the Islamist movement that rules Gaza, it's a terrorist organization. This editorialist not one time mentions the word terrorism. Not one time. I mean, the Iron Dome is an extraordinary achievement. It is keeping innocent Israelis from being massacred by the Hamas terrorists who are firing thousands of rockets. And yet, it perpetuates this conflict. It gives Israelis a false sense of security. And this isn't guaranteed forever, because Hamas is going to keep firing rockets into Israel. And this moral equivalency between terrorists and Israelis tells you everything you need to know about the left. It's extraordinary. From Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, AOC. Let me get this straight. Hamas terrorists fire rockets into Israel, and politicians like the Squad immediately say Palestinians deserve to live. Palestinians need to be protected. Palestinians are being attacked. That's like saying if somebody in the neighborhood was firing rockets into their next door neighbor, you'd immediately defend the person who's firing the rockets into the next door neighbor's home. And all the next door neighbor wants to do is be left alone. When Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar are screeching about the evil Israelis and how terrible it is that they're protecting themselves with the Iron Dome and with retaliatory airstrikes that are wiping out Hamas, and yes, civilians are dying. We know that. We know that Hamas puts civilians in harm's way as a tactic. Let's just go with the Washington Post's assessment that Hamas is firing rockets trying to kill Israelis in response to the threat of eviction of Palestinian residents in a Jerusalem neighborhood. Are you kidding? Are you kidding?
Coming up, Dennis Prager looks at a shocking statement.
A black can say anything because the left has contempt for blacks.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Race relations have proven to be quite complicated, tense in the past year, and there appears to be little middle ground between those who wish to fight over it. My friend and colleague Dennis Prager takes a close look at a recent statement that he found particularly troubling.
Ben Philippe wrote a book. In it, there's a portion about gassing white people. Here, I'll read it to you. The book is titled, Sure, I'll Be Your Black Friend. Quote, when this race war hits its crescendo, I'll gather you all into a beautifully decorated room under the pretense of unity. I'll give a speech to civility and all the good times we share. I'll smile as we raise glasses to your good white health, while the detonator blinks under the table, knowing the exits are locked and the air vents filled with gas. By the way, you think they will even raise the issue of his continuing to teach at Barnard? Of course not. Imagine any other group that this was written of, gassing them all. That would be the end of the person's career. Gas all blacks, gas all Jews, gas all Native Americans, gas all Pakistanis. It doesn't matter. But gas all whites, you get tenure. That's not the biggest shock. Thanks to this woman, the woman identified online as host Talia Schlanger. She's obviously shocked. I'm a Jewish person, and grandparents survived the Holocaust, Schlanger told the Professor Philippe. I can't tell you how it felt to read that sentiment. So you would think, given that my grandparents were in the Holocaust, how awful I find the idea of gassing all members of a race. So this is what she said, and I wanted to say to you that I'm so sorry that your experience of the world made you feel that way. That, to me, would be like saying to Himmler, I'm so sorry that your experiences have led you to want to gas all Jews. The rot in much of Jewish life, which I can easily attest to as a very involved Jew, is beautifully symbolized by this woman's despicable reaction to this despicable black professor.
What would happen if there was a race war, and what side you would be on? And you took it to a place that I just found really shocking and disturbing to read. Would you say a little bit about that?
Sure. Actually, fun fact, that section used to be so much longer. So thank you to my editor for like condensing it. Mm-hmm. I'm a big Dungeons and Dragons person, so I went into advanced world building of what that race war could look like. Mm-hmm. And they were just like, no, maybe just like half a page. Mm-hmm. It was ultimately just trying to take the state of the world to its logical conclusion. If we all have to sort of exist in this common land together, and we can't get along, and we can't heal, and we can't try to understand each other, if it's always going to be us versus them, define the us, define the them, however you want, then, you know, I guess I was wrestling with the question that isn't the end result of that just all-out warfare, like Game of Thrones-style warfare? And what does that look like? And I lived in that sort of a straight thought for a few pages. And it was disturbing to write, too, because I'm not a violent person. I love all my white friends.
Well, let's, for people who haven't read the book, you write about, you say When this race war hits its crescendo, I'll gather you all into a beautifully decorated room under the pretense of unity. I'll give a speech to civility and all the good times we've shared. I'll smile as we raise our glasses to your good white health while the detonator blinks under the table, knowing the exits are locked and the air vents filled with gas. I'm a Jewish person and grandparents survived the Holocaust. I can't tell you how it felt to read that sentiment. And I wanted to say to you that I'm so sorry that your experience of the world made you feel that way and made you feel compelled to write that. How do you reflect on?
There you go.
There is really little that I could say to accurately describe her sickness in that reaction and what the left how the left has perverted people. Her grandparents were Jews in the Holocaust. She reads a segment from this despicable human being who writes that he would like to gas all whites. And her reaction is, I'm so sorry you feel that way. Because in this wimp, Talia Schlanger's world, you don't confront anybody but whites. A black can say anything because the left has contempt for blacks. We don't judge you blacks the way we judge whites. If a white wrote something like that, she would never say, I'm so sorry that life's pains have brought you to this point. The most racism in this country, but there is no close second, emanates from the left. Blacks are used and blacks are held in contempt by every leftist. And there's no excuse for adult naivete, none. It means you are too weak to confront yourself and your values and evil. That's all it means. When an adult is naive, they have chosen to be naive. Life consists of choices. If a 12-year-old is naive, I understand. I don't even want 12-year-olds naive, but I understand. 50-year-old? It's inexcusable. Talia Schlanger. She'll be remembered for that. Oh, I'm so sorry you feel that way. You want to gas all whites? What did yes? And invoking that her grandparents, for all we know, were gassed there.
For the entire discussion from Dennis Prager, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up, why are so many workers refusing to take jobs that are abundant and open?
I mean, there are some people who are literally making double their normal wage on unemployment.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt when we return.
This is Jerry Boyer. Take a few minutes and join me for the first episode of my new podcast, Meeting of Minds with Jerry Boyer, where I interviewed the brilliant tech entrepreneur and thinker, Peter Thiel.
The idea of a victim, the idea that victims exist, it comes from Judeo-Christianity and nowhere else. You know, if you sort of imagine Christ in the time of Pontius Pilate, if he had told Pilate, you know, I am a victim, this would have made no sense whatsoever. Pilate would have said, no, are you a Roman citizen or not?
Here's Thiel on victimhood.
The idea that you were a victim made no sense at all. And it's maybe deformed, maybe gone crazy in modernity where we talk about victims and nothing else.
To hear Thiel on atheism, the Bible, Jesus, the cross and resurrection, political correctness and violence, and a whole lot more, go to meetingofmindspodcast.com. Listen, subscribe, and share. That's meetingofmindspodcast.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The United States economy recently faced two problems that normally cancel each other out. High unemployment and lots of available jobs. What on earth is happening? Salem host Mike Gallagher explained.
People don't want to go back to work. People are not knocking down the doors to re-enter the workforce. Look at the April jobs numbers. They thought we'd add over 1 million jobs. We added a quarter of that. And they were all shocked. What was it, the MSNBC clowns that were like, they thought it was a typo? And we're looking at the number and they said, oh, is this a mistake? 266,000 jobs, it was supposed to be over a million? Well, duh. If you had the choice between staying home, being with your family, and making more money by not working, would you take that? Or would you say, no, I got to go to work. I'm going to make less money, but at least I'll be productive. I'll be working 8, 9, 10, 12 hours a day. And Governor Abbott, like Governor McMaster in South Carolina, like other governors, are saying enough. We cannot keep relying on government assistance. And these are red state governors. Blue state governors probably aren't going to do this. I don't see leftist governors cutting off the government dole anytime soon. That's not how they think. It's not how they operate. You think Cuomo or Gavin Newsom or Gretchen Whitmer are going to say no more government assistance? South Carolina's doing it. Texas is doing it. I mean, there are some people who are literally making double their normal wage on unemployment. It's easy to sit back and denounce somebody who's not working and making double. You're kidding me? You're going to tell me that people are going to go back into the workforce and go back to making half what they're making as long as the government has their hand out? You think about a young family. Maybe they've got two young kids at home. Normally, they'd be having to, you know, get childcare, babysitters. You got quality time together. I mean, you're making, double on unemployment what they would make if they went into the work, back into the workforce. This cannot be sustained. It just can't. But people don't want to go back. Here's a text message. Mike, I work in the food industry. For the last several months, it's been horrible trying to hire people. Because they do not want to come back to the workforce. It is time to stop the extra pay. And this is never going to happen from Biden. You understand, Biden wants to keep it going indefinitely. You know, and what I hope people understand is there's no government money tree. We're paying this. You and I are paying it.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. And sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schumann, producers Charlie Richards, David Pouchon, Michael Cook, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, Harley Eady, Ben Brigman, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.